Today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about prophecy, and I want to get back into the history of some of the things that are going on today and end up with a prophecy in one of the books of the Old Testament. I want you to turn with me back to the book of Genesis so we get a running start or an understanding of where all these things that we see today have really had their roots and where they're coming from. Turn with me to the book of Genesis, chapter 25. We know that in the news today we read and hear and see a lot of the things that are going on. Not everyone understands where these things came from. But in Genesis chapter 25, I want you to put in there at verse 19. Verse 19 gives a history of Israel, gives a history of Isaac, and the seed of Abraham. Notice in Genesis 25 and verse 19, it reads, "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban and Syrian," and so on. So we find this, that he had a wife. And as we move on down, in verse 22, she was pregnant and had twins within her. And it says they were struggling. Verse 23, "Yahweh said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger.'" Generally, you know, in the scriptures, the elder was usually the one that became the priest of the family, more or less. He had the responsibility to bring the family along in case something happened to the parents. So here we find that there are two nations, two peoples about to be born. What is interesting here is that the younger is going to serve as the older, and the older is going to be subservient to the younger. Verse 24, "And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau," which means hairy. And then, of course, in verse 26 came the other one, and his name was Jacob, because he had hold of his brother's heel. And the word Yaakov really means supplanter, or grabbing hold of someone's heel, of taking over something. And we find verse 27, "The boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, the man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents." And Yahweh said there would be two different worlds, two different nations that would come and be different. We find in verse 28 that Isaac, the father, loved Esau because he did eat his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So here we have a difference between the two. And we find that Jacob, in verse 29, was making pottage. Esau came in from the field. He was faint and he was hungry. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray you, some of your red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore, his name was called Edom. That gives us a clue of what's going on today. Who is Edom? Where do we find him? Why does he have the nature he has today? We're given clues here. Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point of death. What profit is there in my birthright?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he swore unto him, and he sold him his birthright unto Jacob. In fact, you will find that Jacob is really quite a crook. He really wheels and deals, and he does a lot of things. But the interesting point, all of his wheeling and dealing comes back on him. When he goes to get married, he married Leah instead of Rachel, and had some tricks played on him. which is another study, another story. But it's interesting that we're looking here at Jacob. And Jacob was this way until he wrestled with the angel. When he wrestled with the angel and his thigh was put out of joint, from that point onward, his walk was different. Some think that he actually limped from that point forward. Well, I'm getting off track here. Notice up here, verse 34 says that Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. In chapter 26, let's move on down there. There was a famine in the land, and all these things take place. Yahweh appeared unto Isaac, and he said, "Dwell in the land that I'll tell you of, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For unto you and unto your seed I will give these countries." Notice it's two countries that he's talking about here, because there are two twins. "And I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham your father. I will make your seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and give unto thy seed all these countries." Some of the commentators read a verse like this, "stars of heaven," and feel this is talking about a spiritual progeny, that from these two will come the two great religions of the world. And notice it says, "I will give unto your seed all these countries," and that's talking about the Middle East, the area of Basra, and in that area, even Afghanistan and Israel, the land of Palestine. And he's doing it not for anything they have done, but verse 5 says he's doing it because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So Abraham is reaping something even after his death. Let's move on down. I don't want to take up a lot of time with this, but just to give you a background of this, go down to verse 34. Verse 34, excuse me. It says, "Esau was 40 years old when he took the wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And there was a grief to the mind of Isaac and to Rebekah." You might wonder, what has all that got to do with it? Well, over in the book of Numbers, you don't have to turn there, I'll see if I can find it in a hurry. And Numbers chapter 7, they were to move in the land later on. But notice in reading this, in chapter 7 of the book of Numbers, did I say Numbers? I'm supposed to be in Deuteronomy. Numbers has another one, but in Deuteronomy chapter 7, basically, it talks about the fact that there were some nations there they were not to have anything to do with. And we find here that in Numbers chapter 7, verse 7 says, "Yahweh did not set his love upon you nor choose you because you were the most of any people, but he chose Israel because of the promise he made to Abraham." But notice in verses 1 and 2, it talks about bringing them into the land. And then he says, "But there are nations, many nations." He mentions seven specifically. And he says, he will cast out these nations. And they were the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. They were to kill them to a man, get rid of them all. The reason this is important, because the first one we read about here in this seventh chapter of Deuteronomy is the Hittites. And you go back here and look at Esau, he married two women from the Hittites, two Hittite women. And it says there that Rebekah was sorrowful because he was not marrying into the family. He was marrying these pagan people, and she knew that he would be going away from the truth more and more. So then we find the next thing you want to look at in chapter 27, in verse 24, the father Isaac is going to make a blessing, and he knows his time is about up. He's about ready to die. So in this 27th chapter, he decides that he is going to bless the one he likes, which is Esau. Instead, Rebekah takes Jacob, has him dress up and put on the clothing of Esau and pretend that he is Esau himself. So in verse 22, we find that Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and his father felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He was a hairy man. What Rebekah had done is put some animal skins on his flesh. So when the father felt them, they would feel real hairy. And that's what happened. I don't want to spend a lot of time with that, but to notice again, here's Jacob deceiving and working out his own agenda, working out his own program. Move on down to verse 44. Well, what happens, of course, Esau finds out about the betrayal, and he is ready to kill Jacob. So we have in verse 44 that Rebekah tells Jacob to go away and stay with Laban, her brother. That's in verse 43, which he does. And then she says, "Do that until," in verse 45, "your brother's anger turn away from you, and he forget that which you have done to him. And I will send and fetch you from thence. Why should I be deprived also you both in one day?" So there we find this is what actually takes place. In verse 46, Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a daughter of Heth, such as those which are the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do to me?" So this is the problem they're wondering about. What is going to happen next? She's worried that maybe her beloved Jacob would marry another one of these pagan women from those seven nations. Let's go over to, move on down to chapter 28. Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take thee a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And El Shaddai bless and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be a multitude of people, and give you the blessings of Abraham to you and the seed with you, that you may inherit the land whereunto you are, where you are a stranger, which Elohim gave to Abraham." So he was sent away, and he went to Paddan Aram unto Laban, son of Bethuel and the Syrian, and the brother of Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau's mother. And when Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take him a wife from thence, that he blessed him and gave him a charge, saying, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan," and that Jacob had obeyed his mother and was gone to Paddan Aram, Esau, seeing the daughters of Canaan, pleased not Isaac his father. Then went Esau unto Ishmael and took the wives from which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth, to be his wife. What Esau now does, he amalgamates himself with Ishmael. Ishmael is the Arab, and Edom, as he's later known, is actually making friends and actually becoming a part of Ishmael. So why is all this important? Because we find that the brother of the Israelites, Esau, has joined himself with Ishmael, the Arab. And the things that Ishmael has done are taken many, many times from the way that Esau treated people. And they're two of a kind. the way they act. And you'll find that in chapter in this chapter 28. I want you to move on down there to, let's see here. Here's the promise that is given then to Jacob in chapter 28 and verse 10. He came to a certain place and he dreamed a dream. This is when he, in fact, it's called Jacob's Ladder. And the top of the ladder or staircase reaches up to heaven. The angels of Elohim ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, Elohim of Abraham, your father, the mighty one of Isaac. The land whereon you liest, to thee will I give it, and to your seed. And to thy seed will be, your seed will be like the dust of the earth, and shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, to the north, and to the south. And in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now this is talking about Jacob and the 12 tribes. They will be spread all over the world. The 10 tribes, of course, were driven out by the Assyrians, and they went first over across the Caucasian Mountains between the Black Sea and that area of Crimea, and they finally just became lost. But here's the prophecy saying they'll be all around the world. And later on, we'll find other prophecies that say they will be sent all over the earth and will be lost, but Yahweh will not lose a one of them. And then in this verse 14, he also says, in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. You have to wonder, have the families of the earth been blessed by the Arabs? Or have they been blessed by the European nations? I think when you consider that, the progress that has been made in Europe and in America is by far outclassed and reached beyond what the Arabs have been able to do in their part of the country. Most of them stayed there. So we have this prophecy, I think, back here in the Old Testament telling us what's going to happen. I don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but we want to go next to chapter 30. Well, wait a minute, I got to finish up here with Jacob. Jacob here is having this dream, and verse 16, he's awakened out of his sleep, and he says, I'm certain Yahweh is in this place. I just feel it. And verse 17, he was afraid. And he rose up in the morning, took a stone that he had for pillows, and set it for a pillar, and poured oil on it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, the home of El, house of El. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if Elohim will be good to me and keep me in this way, that I will go, and he will give me a bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house, then I will worship Yahweh. Before that, he apparently wasn't worshiping Yahweh, even though his father Isaac was a firm believer in Yahweh. And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, excuse me, will be Yahweh's house. And all of that that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. So Jacob promises that's what he's going to do. Well, later on, of course, after this, he has a little problem, but I want to get into that just now. Let's turn over to chapter 36 in the book of Genesis. In chapter 36, we have here the nations and the generations of Esau, known as Edom. Esau took wives of the daughters of the Canaanite, which he was not supposed to do. Ada, the daughter, Inna gives the daughters of the Hittites. That was one of the nations mentioned in Deuteronomy. Hivites, another one. And Ishmael's daughter. So we find here that Esau's progeny was actually made up of the ones that Yahweh did not approve of. And he continued to do that. And then, I don't want to read all this, but it says, verse 6, took his wives and daughters and so on in the land of Canaan and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. So Edom, or Esau, however you want to call him, is often referred to as Mount Seir because that is where they worshipped. And so we find that they're often called Edomites. They're called those of Esau and so on. In this 36th chapter, again, as we continue looking at it, we find... excuse me. We find it gives the entire history here of the children of Israel. I mean, of Esau. And after a while, we get into the one of Joseph. What I'd like to do here in chapter... let's see. Chapter 33, if you'll back up there a little bit. In chapter 33, we have Jacob coming home again. And Esau is there. And Jacob now is concerned after having his wives, Leah and Rachel, and the families. He was a very wealthy man, as you probably remember. Jacob was quite a herdsman. He actually was a cattle breeder. And what he told Laban was, he said, tell you what we'll do. All the cattle that are spotted or speckled or have stripes, those will be mine. But the ones that are not, that are pure bloods, they will be yours. And Laban says, sounds good to me. Let's do it that way. Well, as you probably know, the law reproduction says that there are certain phases of cattle that are always going to dominate. You have recessive. So as a result of that, all of the cattle, it seemed, were all Jacob's. And Laban got the purebreds, but there weren't very many of them because if they had a spot or a wrinkle or stripe, they belonged to Jacob. So he had many cattle. He was a rich man. And we find here that in verse 1 of 33, he's coming back home again. He has a lot of cattle, and it's quite a spread he has. But what he does now, he divides the children between Leah and Rachel, and he has two groups there. And the idea in mind is that if Esau comes and tries to kill him, he would get only one batch of of his family, one tribe, or one under Leah, or one under Rachel, and the other one could escape. That was his plan. Always thinking. So we find here that before he got there, that Jacob saw Esau in verse 3, bowed himself to the ground 7 times. Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, lifted up his eyes and says, who are all these people and what's all this about here? And he said, well, the children that Yahweh gave me. And all the children and the handmaids and so on come over and they all get to know each other. And as you move on down there, verse 8, Jacob says, what do you mean by all this drove that I met? Or, I mean, Esau asked that. And Jacob says, these are to find grace in the sight of my master. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have unto yourself. So Jacob was going to give him all kinds of cattle. And Jacob said, no. He said, I pray you, if now I have found grace in your sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen you face to face, though I had not seen the face of Elohim, and you were pleased with me. Take, I pray you, my blessing that is brought to you, because Elohim has dealt graciously with me, and I have enough. And he urged him, and Esau took the cattle and so on. So we find that Esau took the cattle, but you don't read there where he said he forgave Jacob. Doesn't say that at all. He still carried the grudge. Probably has it to this day. So here we have a little background of who Jacob is, and we know that from Jacob came His name was changed when he wrestled to Israel. And we find then that his progeny stayed there in the Middle East for a little while. Eventually, they were driven out and went over to, like I said, the Caucasus Mountains. Got to be called Caucasians. And they moved into Europe, and from Europe they moved around the world to Australia, Canada, South America, and so on. But the people of Esau stayed there in that Middle Eastern area. They're still there today. Well, I hope that gives us a little background of who those people are, because I think when we study the background, we can understand what kind of people they are and why they do what they do, simply because it's their nature. And you find that the Arabs, even to after the time of the Messiah, the Arabs got to be the Catholic Church called them Saracens, Saracens, and they were always fighting with them, and various things that the Christians have done going into the Crusades, where they killed all the Jews they could find, they killed all the Arabs they could find, the Saracens, and the war was going on even then. And I think today we see it coming into the fore again. Once more, we're going to have a war between Christianity and Islam. It looks to me like what we're doing over in Afghanistan is primarily against the people over there in Afghanistan. I noticed when our president spoke one time, one of the first talks he gave, he talked about a crusade against the terrorist. But he never used that word crusade again. Probably brought memories of the crusades under some of the popes, where they, especially Urban II, where his was one of the most successful. But the interesting point is this. A lot of people think that our fight is against Islam exclusively. Well, it's primarily against the Arabs, because Turkey is not made up of Arabs. They're all Turks, but they are all people from Islam. And you find that Egypt, they're not Arabs either, but they're made up of Islamic people, but they're Egyptians. And we have, of course, Iran. They're all Persians, and yet they're all Islamic. Iraq, the same way. They're all Babylonians under Saddam Hussein, but they're not Arabs. They're Babylonians. And you find that in Indonesia, Malaysia, and through there, they're all Oriental people. They're not Arabs either. And yet they're all following Islam. What kind of bothers some of the people is when they ask those who had been living here up in Michigan for a number of years, maybe two or three generations, and they ask them, what do you really think this Islamic religion of yours, is it still strong in your area? And they said, yes, we practice it every Friday. And the question was asked, if you were given the command to do away with somebody or even to join the Taliban people, would you do that rather than stay here and fight against them? They said, well, we wouldn't want to fight against them. We'd probably join them. Things like this kind of bother some of the people, but you don't hear the news reports talk about this very much. To be politically correct, you don't run down the Arabs. But they are the ones really that are giving us the problem over there, because they are the ones that probably are the ones in Palestine and the ones that are angry with us because we support the Jews. And they're the ones that have really done some of the things that are kind of worrisome and makes us wonder what's all going to happen here pretty soon. I don't know if you've looked into the readings of the Quran. People claim it doesn't say anything bad. Well, it does in several places. In fact, I should have brought my Quran up here and read it to you. But it says that they're looking for everyone to become a convert to Islam. And if you aren't an Islamic or a Muslim, then you are their enemy. And then they're trying to convert the whole world to the Islamic religion. And if they can do that, they'll have achieved their goal. And they have no qualms at all about saying that. In fact, it says that America is the great Satan. And America is the one that is actually against Islam because we're a Christian nation, so-called. But anyway, I think we're in a real battle here, and I think we're going to have a lot of problems yet. I know that some of the people I used to work with never actually knew what the Islamic people were doing. And some of the Islamic people that I got to know, worked with, didn't really know the Quran at all. In fact, they're like Christianity. Nobody knows what the Bible really says. They think Hebrews is a book of the Old Testament, and they think that so many of these things all are against obedience to the law, and have no idea what the real truth is. But there is a book in the Bible that I mentioned before that talks about Edom. And I'd like to have you turn over there with me. It's up the book of Obadiah. Obadiah is a hard book to find. It's a short book. It's after the book of Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. After the book of Amos, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So it's in that part of the Bible. After the book of Amos. But it's a relatively short book. And what I want to do is read it to you from another translation. I hope you all have a King James or something like that. But this is the one of the Bible I've just came into my hand, called the Open Bible. And you might be hearing more about it. But I was kind of amazed when I was reading it about its truthfulness and about its frankness and openness. And Obadiah is read this way. This is the vision that the sovereign Yahweh revealed to Obadiah concerning the land of Edom. We have heard a message from Yahweh that an ambassador was sent to the nations to say, "Get ready, everyone. Let's assemble our armies and attack Edom." I think the great Satan might have said that. That is, President Bush, that's what they call him, you know, going to attack the terrorists. Yahweh says, "I will cut you down to the size of the nations, Edom. You will be small and despised." Verse 3, "You are proud because you live in a rock fortress and make your home high in the mountains. Who can ever reach us way up here?" you ask boastfully. "Don't fool yourselves." Verse 4, "Though you soar as high as eagles and build your nest among the stars, I will bring you crashing down. I, Yahweh, have spoken. If thieves came at night and robbed you, they would not take everything. Those who harvest grapes always leave a few for the poor. But your enemies will wipe you out completely. Every nook and cranny of Edom will be searched out and looted. Every treasure will be found and taken." Verse 7, "All your armies will turn against you. They will help to chase you from your land. They will promise you peace while plotting your destruction. Your trusted friends will set traps for you, and you won't even know about it." Verse 8, "At the time, not a single person or a single wise person will be left in the whole land of Edom, says Yahweh. For on the mountains of Edom I will destroy everyone who has wisdom and understanding." 9, "The mightiest warriors of Teman will be terrified, and everyone in the mountains of Edom will be cut down in slaughter." Verse 10, "And why? Because of the violence you did to your close relatives in Israel. Now you will be destroyed completely and filled with shame forever." Verse 11, For you deserted your relatives in Israel during their time of greatest need. You stood aloof, refusing to lift a finger to help when foreign invaders carried off their wealth and cast lots to divide up Jerusalem. You acted as though you were one of Israel's enemies. You shouldn't have done this. You should not have gloated when they exiled your relatives to distant lands. You shouldn't have rejoiced because they were suffering such misfortune. You shouldn't have crowed over them as they suffered these disasters. Verse 13. You shouldn't have plundered the land of Israel when they were suffering such calamity. You shouldn't have gloated over the destruction of your relatives, looting their homes, making yourselves rich at their expense. Verse 14, you shouldn't have stood at the crossroads, killing those who tried to escape. You shouldn't have captured the survivors, handing them over to their enemies in that terrible time of trouble. The results of the judgment of Edom comes next. And we read there in verse 15, the day is near when I, Yahweh, will judge the wicked nations, as you have done to Israel, so it will be done to you. All your evil deeds will fall back on your heads. Just as you swallowed up my people on my holy mountains, so you and the surrounding nations will swallow the punishment I pour out on you. Yes, you nations will drink and stagger and disappear from history as though you had never even existed. But Jerusalem shall become a refuge for those who escape. It will be a holy place, and the people of Israel will come back to reclaim their inheritance. At that time, Israel will be a raging fire, and Edom a field of dry stubble. The fire will roar across the field, devouring everything, and leaving no survivors in Edom. I, Yahweh, have spoken. Verse 19, then my people living in the Negev will occupy the mountains of Edom. Those living in the foothills of Judah will possess the Philistine plains and take over the fields of Ephraim and Samaria. And the people of Benjamin will occupy the land of Gilead. Verse 20, the exiles of Israel shall return to their land and occupy the Phoenician coast as far north as Zarephath. The captives from Jerusalem, exiled in the north, will return to their homeland and resettle the villages of the Negev. Verse 21, deliverers will go up to the Mount Zion in Jerusalem and rule over the mountains of Edom, and Yahweh himself shall be king. I couldn't help but read that and wonder if this war we have now is going to spread over to the Middle East where Israel is now. Because it seems that the battle and the prophecies are zeroing in on Edom. I was quite amazed to read the history of Edom and the Esau and all the battles they had, especially with Israel. And sometimes Israel would win most of the time, but sometimes Edom won. And then there were different books that were given, especially this one on Obadiah, written right to Edom, kind of laying out what's going to happen at the end of the age. And I know that sometimes I've read that and it didn't make sense 4 or 5 years ago. Today it makes a lot of sense. I think Yahweh is telling us that no matter what's going on in the world, he's still in charge of things. He'll still be the one that will make the final decision about who wins and loses. And you know that if we're Israelites, that we are on the winning side, because he said that he is going to take care of Israel and he will be the mighty one of Israel. Now it's up to us to make sure we are a part of Israel.